Hello, I'm Dr. Peter Leo. I'm a clinical assistant professor of dermatology and pediatrics at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, and I'm the founding director of the Chicago Integrative Eczema Center. This talk is Advanced Approaches to Itch. I'm really excited for us to get into it because there's so many exciting things here. These are my relevant disclosures. And a number of these companies are working on itch, but almost all of them are really more directly related to atopic dermatitis. And our learning objectives today are to review approaches to modeling itch, to appraise clinical studies on itch therapies, and to illustrate some of the techniques, supplements, and approaches that may improve itch for our patients. We really have to start at the very beginning, and that is with the question, what is itch? And it's a little bit harder to define than I think it seems at first blush. And so what the real itch experts have come to the conclusion of is that the best way to define itch is really with the desire to do an action. So a sensation resulting in an urge to scratch, which is pretty funny, right? But itch is complex, and I think people interpret it and perceive it a little bit differently. So kind of fascinating that that's what it's come to, but I think we all understand what itch is. It's a universal experience. One time or another, all of us have felt an itch. And it really drives people crazy. It has the potential to really damage quality of life when it's really bad, but of course, it's an everyday occurrence. We all know it, and we can alleviate that itch for the most part by simply scratching. So there are some important pathways that underpin this entire itch framework. And we know that pruritogens, or things that can trigger itch, they activate certain receptors on small itch-selective unmyelinated C fibers. This is very similar to pain-type neurons. And they have cell bodies, again, similar to pain, in the dorsal root ganglia. Many of these receptors are G-protein coupled receptors, and in particular, there are two distinct and totally separate subtypes of itch-sensitive neurons. There's the histaminergic neurons and the non-histaminergic neurons. Why is this important? Well, it's really important because so many times people throw antihistamines at itch, and if it's non-histaminergic mediated, then it really doesn't make any sense. So not only, you know, I think clinically do we understand that it really is probably the wrong way to treat it if it's non-histamine related, but I think the just even the underpinnings, the scientific pathways really help us understand why antihistamines don't work for all itch. There really are different pathways. So this is from the work of Dr. Gil Josipovic and others. He is kind of the godfather of itch. And it's very interesting to think about some of the pathways in the body for itch. Here we can see a lot of different concepts. We see the itch triggers going into the skin. We see some of the cell types that are associated with itch, like mast cells, T cells, eosinophils, neutrophils, basophils. We see some of these small itch selective unmyelinated C fibers, and we can see that these go to the dorsal root ganglion and then to the spinal cord and up into the brain. So what's remarkable is that this is happening, of course, all over our skin and other parts of our body as well. And this plays a huge role in our perception of itch in general, but also can be modulated by a lot of different aspects. So we can see here, they're showing us some of the receptors, and we can see how they have different things that bind to them. Proteases, interestingly, bile acids, chloroquine, substance P, which is that spicy part of peppers, in pain-inducing sometimes. IL-31. TSLP, opioids. We all understand this connection of itch and opioids. So there really are their receptors that can respond to these things. And then a little bit deeper down in the process, we have things like TRPV1 and TRPA1, which again are important for transferring these different pathways. Really interesting. There are many things that can cause itch. So pruritogens or itch causers, itch inducers, there's tons of different things, and they have been increasingly found over the years. So there are lipid mediators, there are many different cytokines, and in particular, I'll point out TSLP, IL-4 and IL-13 and IL-31. These are interesting because these are also important targets for medications, chloroquine, bile acids, all these different things that can do. And of course, here at the top, the histamine and serotonin. So itch is pretty complicated, but those cytokines are fascinating because they are really a very modern and de rigueur concept that people are thinking about that we can use to potentially help. This is from another Gil Josipovic paper, again, beautiful showing of itch and the brain. We know that that spinal circuit and some of the brain areas involved in itch perception have now been identified. And we know that the itch has to go through the spinal thalamic tract and to the thalamus, and then it goes to the spinoperibrachial pathway and the peribrachial nucleus, or PBN. These itch signals are then transmitted to a variety of different areas throughout the brain. We can see it's kind of lit up all over the place. And I think it's suffice to say that it's pretty complex. It's not just one area. There's not a simple pain or itch area in the brain that really it's a bit more complex. One of my favorite findings, and this has been shown also in pain, but you can actually induce neural sensitization via triggers in the skin and all the way through the dorsal root ganglion, spinal cord, and brain. And the concept here is that we know that it repeated inflammation, damage, abnormal innervation, all these kinds of changes in the skin from chronic itch scratch cycle actually change both the morphology of the local neurons, the nerve endings themselves. So the dendrites actually change. Their threshold change physiologically. But then we also see changes in the dorsal root ganglia and in the brain. So this process is not entirely benign. You know, we think, oh, they're just scratching. It doesn't really matter. But actually, it matters a lot. They're making fundamental changes and semi-permanent changes to some degree. There's plasticity, but we know that it can be very difficult. Once you've made a lot of nerves, it can take a very long time for them to go back down. Those dendritic processes take some time to regress, if they ever fully regress, if they can ever become fully normal. So it actually makes a lot of sense that thinking about itch and blocking it early on is probably very, very beneficial, getting on top of that itch. So here they're showing us the upregulation of itch-related receptors and molecules in that dorsal root ganglion, and then dysfunction of the inhibitory circuits in some of the different neurons in here. So really amazing. And this, again, similarly has been shown with pain. There's a beautiful study looking at damaging a mouse foot pad, and they were kind of mimicking what might happen in a NICU, in a neonatal intensive care unit, where they're drawing blood from the heel stick, over and over. And they actually could find in the dorsal root ganglia, the neurons that are associated to that, that connect with that pathway, are hypertrophic. They're different. They're changed. And then there are these studies that show babies that have had painful experiences early in life, they actually have a lower pain threshold. In other words, their pain has been strengthened. It's kind of intense, and it makes us think about, here's an image from that paper I was talking about. So this is the mouse model of foot pad stimulation causing, you know, semi-permanent, or at least for a while, somewhat chronic changes that may be difficult or impossible to reverse. So similarly with pain, we say pain cannot be treated if pain cannot be assessed, and the same goes for itch. So how do we measure itch? And this turns out to be a little bit easier than defining itch. There are a number of different ways to do it, from numeric scales, usually 0 to 10, no itch to worst imaginable, to a visual analog scale where you can sort of put a tick mark, essentially the same thing. They're very similar, but some patients might do better with one or the other. And in kids, they even do like faces and things like that to kind of help make it a little bit more approachable for the kids. And there are a number of other things that can be done, however. So beyond those different types of scales, there are different multidimensional ways to measure it, like itch severity scale, pruritus grading system, actigraphy, where you're measuring the movement of the hand. I'm involved in a study right now where there's a device that sticks to the back of the hand and looks at scratching behavior, particularly at night. It's one of the hardest things to measure. Similarly, accelerometers. Also, you can ask some of the bigger questions, like how many itch-free days have you had? There are apps that help track it, and so on and so forth. So there are many ways to do it. Sometimes we'll get into these big arguments about what's the best way to measure it. And I often think it's a little bit like other aspects of quality of life, like sleep. People want all these fancy ways to try to measure sleep, but to a certain degree, and I'm all for basic science and continuing to learn and study it. This is important work. But from a clinical trial perspective, at some point you sort of hit a limit, a threshold. It doesn't really matter how much better we can measure the sleep that's impaired. If the patient feels good and says their sleep is better, to some degree, we've kind of accomplished that goal. And that's what some of these simpler scales can do and itch scales can do. So I liken it to, you know, world hunger is a major problem, right? Poverty and world hunger is terrible. We want to fix it. But is it worth putting millions and millions of dollars to doing better hunger scales and hunger monitoring to figure out the depth of hunger? Like at some point, it's like, gosh, like these people said they're hungry. Let's just use the time and energy to work on fixing the hunger instead of studying the nuances of their hunger. And that's kind of how I feel sometimes. Like, how much nuance do we want on itch? You know, 1 to 10. I'm miserable, doc. I've got a 9 out of 10. I can't sleep. Okay. Like, I gotcha. You know, when they come back, how are you feeling? I'm great. Barely any itch. We did it, you know? So I don't know how much more I need for measurement, but it's interesting. Many animals itch, of course, dogs who have bad eczema scratch themselves up really badly. And interestingly, some of the dogs will bite at their skin so much that they'll actually have hair actually inserted into their gingiva because they're constantly chewing on their own fur and it causes troubles. Here's a nice kangaroo scratching. So four categories of itch when we're making the diagnosis clinically. That's a little bit of the basic science, but now we got to think clinically. The first, of course, is dermatologic itch. So this is ideally something that we can identify and diagnose as a primary dermatologic disease, most commonly atopic dermatitis, maybe fairly commonly psoriasis, something like that. The next one is neuropathic, and these include things like localized neuropathies like brachioradialis pruritus, but also more generalized things like small fiber neuropathies, psychogenic itch, and of course, remember, it's important to know that these are not necessarily mutually exclusive, and frequently these guys come with each other. So you might have somebody who has really bad dermatologic itch, but now they have a psychogenic component. We see this, you know, when people are anxious or when they're scared or when they're feeling that sensation, they can often scratch themselves to start this behavioral cycle. And then, of course, there's systemic or metabolic types of itch, like end-stage renal disease. So these are important things to think about when we see an itchy patient. I would say in the dermatology clinic, you know, 9 times out of 10, or maybe even 99 times out of 100, depending on where you practice, there's going to be a dermatologic reason. But sometimes there is not, and we ought to be paying attention. For me, that's more worrying, you know, than a dermatologic disease. I'd like to be able to put my hands on it and know what I'm treating. And it's always nerve-wracking when you have what they call pruritus sine materia, right? Itch without any material rash. So you're like, why are you itchy? It could be neuropathic. It could be uremic pruritus, hepatogenic pruritus. So these are sort of the metabolic or systemic reasons, iron deficiency. You know, it goes on and on. So there are a number of things we want to think about. And one of the things I think we also want to think about is occult cancer. It's pretty darn rare, but I've actually had a couple of cases where paraneoplastic disease, you know, is the itch. So the underlying problem is a cancer, and it could be a Hodgkin lymphoma. It could be cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. It could be something else, but we want to keep an eye out for these issues. And we want to do a systemic workup if we can't find any reason for an itch. We want to always have a reason for an itch. We might be wrong. You know, we might think that it was, you know, irritant dermatitis due to the bedding, you know, or due to the fabric softener, fine. But then when they come back, if they're not better, then we have to say, okay, maybe it wasn't that. We need to go on. There's no shame in you know, taking our best guess and treating, but there is shame if we sort of just say, oh, I don't know, I can't help you. We kind of have to keep going. So what's the workup we can do? Well, this is obviously not exhaustive, but I want to, you know, be at least a little bit illustrating what we might do. And of course, we want the patient's history and their exam to help shape us too. So, you know, depending on what their background is, but we want to check for dermatographism. Do we see that? If we see that, that helps us think that it may be more of an occult urticarial process going on. We want to check CMP because we want to look at the liver and look at the kidney function, a CBC to make sure there's not any issues like in terms of anemia that's causing this, that could be underlying iron deficiency, but also it could be an early sign potentially of a malignancy, depending on what's going on with their cell lines. We want to look at alk-phos, LDH, uric acid. And again, if we really suspect it, maybe even a chest x-ray just to look, and then close follow-up with primary care. Very honestly, I usually will not do a chest x-ray from my office. I'll do the beginning. If I find nothing and we're going to kind of discharge them back to primary care, I'm going to say, you know, we're going to do some other things for their itch. We're going to keep working on it. But I will ask that you keep up with their malignancy screening because I'm worried about this, you know, and I'll work with them to coordinate chest x-ray and so on. But certainly you could do it yourself. So once we have some idea of what we're treating, and again, sometimes we don't know until the very end, or sometimes we never know. I have lots of patients who've just been itchy for years and we don't really have a good working diagnosis. It doesn't really quite fit into any of these. We just know they have chronic pruritus. We don't understand what's driving it. So we do have to try to treat them while we're doing this. Though again, they're not mutually exclusive. Ideally, we would keep the workup going and keep an eye on things while getting them better. We don't want them to have to wait. So there are kind of four basic steps on this therapeutic ladder. The first one is going to be topical agents that we can use. The next one would be what I like to call the safe systemics. The third are the more powerful systemics that have some more trade-offs. And the fourth are going to be some of the alternative or complementary approaches that I think are just interesting to keep in your back pocket. And these are not for everybody, but I like to share them because I think they have something of worth for us to talk about. So let's start with our topicals. And this is a beautiful figure again from Gil Yosipovich. That's where you go when you have itch questions. He's an amazing clinician. An amazing researcher. So of course, our corticosteroids are really going to be one of the things we start with. They tend to help in a number of different ways. Of course, we think about them as being primarily anti-inflammatory, but they are also anti-itch. They have some effect on the blood vessels as well, and you know, are doing many things in the skin. Of course, they can help with a lot of types of itch, but lots of potential problems, especially in the long term. Skin atrophy, stria, telangiectasia, changes in pigment. So we have to be careful. We have to be, you know, cautious and somewhat conservative with our steroid use. We don't want to just have them bathe in the triamcinolone jar. They can do it for a little, but then we need to be thinking elsewhere. Of course, calcineurin inhibitors like tacrolimus and pimecrolimus are very helpful. They're particularly good for more sensitive skin areas like anogenital skin. They can be used anywhere on the body, even for eyelids and face. So we like those. They can cause stinging and burning. And of course, they do have that unfortunate FDA box warning for increased risk of malignancy. So that's a little bit of a downer, but we've talked to the patients about that, and we can usually, you know, reassure them that the way we're going to use it for the short time, we really don't think there's actual clinical risk of a malignancy. It remains sort of theoretical. Now, the topical anesthetics have been used, and they can help. They can temporarily decrease that itch sensation, of course, pain as well. But as we said, those fibers are very similar. And these can be extremely helpful in neuropathic itch and uremic pruritus. So pramoxine, lidocaine, prilocaine, and of course, we'll talk about it in a little more detail, the ketamine-amitriptyline combination. So these are pretty neat ways to help, especially in things like prurigo nodularis. And then we have some of the ion channel blockers like capsaicin, and it comes in a cream and in a patch. So that can be helpful. Also things like menthol and camphor, strontium. And then we have some of the newer agents like tofacitinib, crisaboral, and N-palmitoethanolamine or PEA, which actually works a bit like a cannabinoid. It's actually called a cognate. So it's not a true cannabinoid, but it's similar. So these are all things that we can use pretty easily. More practically, that's a little bit of a, you know, kind of a more exhaustive list, but a practical list would be topical steroids and TCIs are a great place to start, kind of see how they're doing. You know, maybe we're using them a little bit and responding really well, and we're kind of done. You know, I had a little itch, my hands were bothering me, much better. Thank you. I'm doing great. Other things, if they don't want to use a prescription thing, we can use some of the over-the-counter preparations, like some of the anti-itch preparations that contain pramoxine and camphor, menthol, calamine, things like that. That can be soothing for mild itch, and that can be a good adjunct. Topical antihistamines are generally a no-no because it actually turns out that topical diphenhydramine is a really good sensitizer. You can get allergic to it. So it doesn't help that much. You could do an oral antihistamine if you wish, which we'll talk about in a moment. And then there are some hydrogels that are kind of fascinating that do seem to have some effect. And these are hypochlorous acid gels. So this is one of them using essentially bleach, right? So they basically have hypochlorous acid and sodium hypochlorite, the active ingredients of bleach. And they do seem to have an effect on itch, particularly in atopic dermatitis. There are a lot of unanswered questions, but now these are actually available over the counter for like $12 or $13 for a big spray bottle. And, you know, some of these are available widely, like just, you know, over online and in the drugstore. So that has changed my use of them. They used to be a couple that were prescription devices. They were 510K devices. So they were very expensive. And this has made it wonderful that I can just get them for, you know, just a few dollars for a big jar. This is fascinating about bleach, though, because it really makes us question, you know, how does bleach work? The initial thinking, in particular, when Dr. Amy Paller did her work a few years ago now, more than 5 or 6 years ago, was that we thought that they were killing staph on the skin. But it turns out that a number of lines of data suggest that the bleach, topical bleach, loop bleach, really doesn't kill staph. It doesn't really affect the microbiome very much. It probably is acting more in terms of transepidermal water loss and barrier repair, and may have some anti-inflammatory effects too. So this is from a paper in 2016 that helps us understand that. So I think bleach is probably not very antimicrobial. Now, crisaboral came out originally at the end of 2016. It then got approved down to 6 months of age, which is kind of neat. 3 months of age nowadays, which is fantastic. So we actually have it for our littlest kids, which is wonderful. And one great thing about this is that it really does have an effect on itch while being pretty safe and gentle. And the problem with it, though, is that it can sting and burn in a fair number of patients. So one issue is just that it can cause some stinging and burning, but it does help with itch and, of course, with inflammation. So those are some topical things that we can do to kind of get something going on for the patient that are generally safe. Let's move into some of our systemic agents that, now, again, these are the ones that are going to be first a little bit more attainable. This is quite a long figure. This shows us a few different things on this table. Our antihistamines we talked about. We can even use things like gabapentin, which has an effect on itch, a number of antidepressants. Big gun would be the opioid modulators like butorphanol. And then there are some medicines that are kind of being studied right now for itch that are not FDA. And really, none of these are FDA approved for itch. Itch does not have a formal FDA designation, but a aprepitant is an NK1 inhibitor. And then, of course, our other immunosuppressants that we can use, like methotrexate, cyclosporin, and other things. So there are a lot of things that we can do systemically, but there are many, many trade-offs. And that is, I think, one of the hardest parts, because you're using everything very off-label. Many of these have issues. One of my favorite teachers, Dr. Sam Michella, who turned 100 this year, who is kind of a veritable Master Yoda, he had a couple of tricks. And it's interesting, Gil Yosipovich also uses something similar. Their favorite sort of safe, this is still the safe zone, because we're going to get into the more dangerous systemics in a moment, but like those immunosuppressants, we try to avoid them when we can. But the safe ones, their favorite combo seems to be gabapentin and mirtazapine. So you could do gabapentin, you could kind of crank it up throughout the day, maybe starting at either 100 milligrams TID if you want to go really gentle, or even 300 milligrams TID. And you know, people can get up to 2,700 milligrams in a day. It's not crazy. So that, you know, 900 TID, crazy. So if I just start at either 100 or 300, and maybe I'll have them start at once or twice a day and then build up to three times a day over a week. And then mirtazapine, it's one of the antidepressants, 15 milligrams up to 45 milligrams at night. That's a really nice combination. And again, fairly safe. You know, there is a black box warning on a lot of the antidepressants, and gabapentin's not perfect, but these are relatively safe. These are not immunosuppressive medicines. Of course, they're off label. Now, specifically in the palliative care setting, there is real trouble with itch. Elderly patients often have a lot of problems going on. There's sort of the senile pruritus, which maybe is not the nicest term, but older patients who are of advanced years who get really bad itch and dry skin. And there are other medical problems, of course, that can be contributing. But I will say this was a beautiful paper a few years ago that kind of showcased some of the evidence. And they actually found that naltrexone, oral naltrexone, was significantly better than a placebo and really has been shown to be effective for itch. Obviously, it's not amazing. It's not going to help everybody. But I can personally attest to the fact that naltrexone orally is a very safe medicine. Obviously, they can't be taking opioids, right? It's very important that they're not taking opioids, because this will block it. It's an opioid antagonist, but really neat. It can help, very safe. Now, another one is gabapentin, which we just mentioned. And again, that actually had pretty convincing data as well, that gabapentin, especially in the setting of uremic pruritus, we know when the kidneys are failing, really seems to help. So these are things that I think we can definitely keep in our back pocket. And again, fairly safe. There's not a ton of side effects of these things. Some of the side effects we touched upon for mirtazapine and many of the antidepressants is the black box warning about suicidality. Interesting little boards fodder is that doxepin can bind to the histamine receptor with 800 times the affinity of antihistamines like hydroxyzine. Pretty neat. And then some of the newer agents like aprepitant can cause neutropenia and bradycardia. So we have to kind of keep an eye on that. And butorphanol is really a big gun. So that's it's an inhaled, an intranasal opioid modulator, but it can cause opioid dependency, it can cause respiratory depression, but I have used it. I will tell you, off label. And I have seen patients who nothing else worked that worked. I mean, it really does. It seems to modulate itch in a very powerful central way. Now, another more recent addition to our armamentarium is dupilumab. Dupilumab is an IL-4, IL-13 monoclonal antibody that is FDA approved for atopic dermatitis, chronic rhinosinusitis with nasal polyposis, and also for asthma in the United States. And we know that for atopic derm, it's actually approved down to age 6 years. But it turns out it has a very powerful effect on the itch of atopic dermatitis. Now, I have not really used it too much outside of AD, but there are reports in the literature that it can help for prurigo nodularis, that it can help for itch not otherwise specified, and sort of, you know, pruritocene materia. But certainly within the context of AD, so that first category of disease, this is a wonderful treatment for that scenario. However, it is definitely not perfect, and there are problems with it. Of course, it's very, very expensive and sometimes hard to get. There are some issues, including conjunctivitis for about 10% and probably higher in certain populations getting conjunctivitis. There are some other things that have been more recently discussed about head and neck dermatitis from it, and some other things. So that has some really good use, but may be limited in certain ways. One drug that is being developed right now is nemolizumab, anti-IL-31 antibody. What's really neat about this one is because we know IL-31 is sort of the master itch. So if we block this, we really expect to see itch. And indeed, when they did it against placebo, we see a very nice dose response curve with the nemolizumab showing significance over placebo for changing the itch score. So this will be something I think we're really excited about, and hopefully we'll have that in the next couple of years. It's in the later stages of development, and if the FDA approves it and it, you know, goes well, we'll hopefully get that as a medication that we can use. So I thought we'd spend the last bit now talking about some of the alternatives that we could potentially use, because of course, some of those things are easier to use than others. If we're going to get into cyclosporine and methotrexate, of course, we know there are many pitfalls. There's all sorts of side effects. And in general, you know, I'm trying to avoid using those things, especially for any long time. You know, I mean, maybe a few months if you have to get someone through it. One thing we didn't mention before we enter this final phase is prednisone. Why don't we use prednisone? Well, you know, prednisone is incredibly effective. And there's no doubt that in the short term, it could get people out of a real mess, right? Like they'll feel so much better almost always. I mean, I feel like the response rate to prednisone is probably above 90% or even higher, even in these weird itches that we don't understand, the itch of, you know, unclear etiology. So pred is fantastic, but two things. Number one, especially if we're considering some of these people may have an underlying malignancy, it makes me a little worried to immunosuppress. And that's also why cyclosporine in particular, methotrexate less so, it's used in some malignancies, but it is ultimately immune suppressing. So it's a little confusing, but I think we want to be extra careful. Number two, prednisone, I always say, is a deal with the devil. You get them better, right? They're so much better. They love you. They're sending you flowers. But then when it wears off, it often is worse. It often does a rebound spike. So if they were here, now they're so much better, but now they're flaring up to here. So we've made things worse, which is against our first principle, first do no harm. And of course, sometimes people abuse prednisone. They'll get it over and over and over, or they'll get intramuscular triamcinolone shots. And that can, you know, it can wreak havoc. It can cause cataracts, glaucoma, high blood pressure, avascular necrosis, you know, and we feel sometimes a little cavalier with prednisone because we do give it out a fair amount. It's like, most people are fine. And heck, pediatricians use it for asthma. And it's true, but it's a little bit like Russian roulette. You know, it's like, yeah, I mean, there's lots of people who've never been shot in Russian roulette, but I still don't want to play. So let's go a little alternative. This was mentioned a little earlier, but without we could delve into it, it's pseudo-alternative. It's not necessarily an herbal or botanical, but it's a little off the beaten track. And it is using topical amitriptyline ketamine for the treatment of brachioradialis pruritus. This was originally up at the Mayo Clinic, Mark Davis and others, really a nice paper. And this is a really cool thing you can mix for your patients. You can have it compounded. There are a couple different formulas. I tend to use the original Mayo one, which is amitriptyline 1%, ketamine 0.5%, in vanacrine to make 50 grams, apply TID to areas as needed, a couple refills. Dr. Yosipovich cranked it up. He multiplied it by a factor of 10 and he added some lidocaine. So he does 10% ketamine, 5% amitriptyline, and 5% lidocaine. Crazy thing is I've not noticed it that different. Like the effect seems to be really good, even at the lower percentage. I don't know. It seems to work fine for my patients. So I've been a little nervous. And there have been a couple reports of especially older people using it to broad areas and actually getting obtunded. So I worry a little bit if you're going to use a higher concentration, especially over a large area, you could do it to localized areas, you know, keep it small and you should be fine. I would argue the side effects are nil, but as soon as you get big, you run the risk of getting some trouble because, you know, ketamine is ketamine and amitriptyline, you can absorb them in big enough amounts. Now, we mentioned naltrexone, a pretty easy medicine to use orally, but it turns out there's actually some evidence for topical naltrexone. You can formulate a 1% topical naltrexone. In one of the studies, more than 70% of the patients experienced significant reduction of pruritus. And when they did a placebo-controlled crossover trial, it clearly demonstrated that the cream with naltrexone had a better effect than placebo. So really cool. I don't do this much, but I think it's fairly inexpensive if you have a good compounder and could be something else to do for a patient who you're running out of options for. Quercetin, now we're getting into the real integrative and alternative stuff. It's a plant-derived flavonoid. It has anti-inflammatory, antioxidant properties. It seems to also be helpful for preventing cancer in some scenarios, obviously not proven, but you know, that's sort of what people talk about it as potentially being helpful for. And there have been a couple studies that look at some similar things. So quercetin itself has not been studied very well for itch, but there is a study of this Motkua fruit extract, which contains quite a bit of quercetin. So that's the thought here. And what they found was that when they inject this pruritogen that makes mast cells degranulate in mice skin, then they give this quercetin fruit extract, you know, in the water, they found that it significantly inhibited the scratching behavior of mice. They controlled even for sedation, direct histamine itch, and locomotive behavior. So it really does seem to have an effect on itch. And I will say, I've given it to patients before. It's very inexpensive. It seems very safe. Again, you get it without a prescription. Usually I'll recommend 400 milligrams two or three times per day. And I do find some patients where it seems to help. It's kind of a neat little adjunct, probably not enough by itself for most, but it could be a little booster. And it's, you know, kind of good for you. I'm like, it's gentle. It's sort of a fruit extract. It's not going to hurt anything. Another one that's interesting is N-acetylcysteine. Now, of course, we know this in the hospital setting as what you give to somebody if their liver is crushed from Tylenol overdose. So this will help restore the liver. It's a glutamate modulator and a glutathione precursor. So it's pretty darn safe. It's used in this tox setting. And there's actually this literature about it helping for behavioral components. So the big study was Grant in 2009, where they actually showed that more than half the patients with trichotillomania, sometimes called trichotillosis, hair pulling, were much or very much improved with N-acetylcysteine compared to only 16% of the placebo group. So it's kind of neat. So maybe there's a behavioral component aspect of this. It does have some anti-inflammatory effect. I have given it to patients and I'll say, you know, what do we got to lose? And again, I'd say kind of mixed results. Some patients really like it. Others say, I don't think it did much. Could be something to try. Impatiens balsamina. This has long been used in folk remedies for itchy patients. And there's a Japanese study looking at an extract from this plant on pruritus and dermatitis development in mice. And what they found was that there was significant inhibition of scratching behavior when they were given this impatiens balsamina. It contains lawsone, which is kind of the same thing that gives henna its color. And thus it can also stain skin and nails if it's, you know, prepared in a way that actually can cause acidification of it. So, you know, like when you got to put a little lemon in the henna to sort of make it stick. Same thing. If you prepare it correctly, you can use it as a stain, or I guess incorrectly, depending on if you're trying to get a stain or not, you can cause trouble, but typically it doesn't unless you prepare it. And they actually did this beautiful graph here showing us the incidence of scratching behavior. So group A was the control. So there's the lot of scratching. Group B got the balsamina, the impatiens balsamina, 24 hours before the measurement. So you can see a significant reduction in the scratching behavior. And group C got it 1 hour before the measurement. So, you know, closer in time. So really neat that it seemed to help with the scratching behavior. Kind of fascinating. And you can get it. Its other name is jewel weed. You know, the problem with these kinds of supplements, though, is that you never really know is the quality, what's the, you know, the sourcing of it. But in theory, if you had a reputable brand, you could consider talking to a patient about using it again as an addition for itch. So in conclusion, itch is pretty terrible. Thus far, we're pretty limited in our treatments, surprisingly, after all this time and all the suffering that itch causes. But with new understanding and new developments in therapeutics, I really think we're on the verge of a huge change. And I think that if we can put together all of the pieces of this puzzle using from the conventional, ideally safe things, and maybe some of these kind of integrative or alternative concepts, we could potentially build itch regimens for patients that can make a big difference in their life. And then for those that we can't, we are hopefully going to have some new and bigger guns that we can lean on in the future. Thank you so much for your attention, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the conference.